Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking apart this week's Question Time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
What's up, everyone? I'm Steve Topple, and it is Topple Uncaged. This is the first ever episode on Sunday, the 18th of November. The Canary have only gone and given me my own podcast. What's come over them? I'm not sure, but I'm let loose, hence why it's called Topple Uncaged. So what can you expect from the show? Well, I'll be kicking off with plucked news. That's where I pull the feathers off this week's stories, dig down to the bare bones of it, and take those last scraps of meat off to find out what is really going on behind the headlines. Every week, I'll then be joined by a great guest in Free Flying With, and we'll be going through some of the bigger stories, looking at them in a bit more detail, and getting mine and my guests' hot takes on what's really going on. After that, I'll be taking on Question Time, yes, BBC QT, taking their questions, and I'll be giving them my answers. And finally in the show, we'll be having Revolutionary Birdsong. Every week, I'm going to give a platform to some of the hottest political music going, getting some of those big banging tunes out there and speaking to the artists behind them to find out what their motivation was to write what they're writing. So, that's what you can expect from me every week. Let's kick things off. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. So, first up this Sunday, it is Plucked News. 5 news stories, 5 minutes, the clock's ticking down. Will I do it? Can I fit them all in? Let's go. So, on Saturday the 17th of November, BBC News reported that Extinction Rebellion protests block London bridges. This is the story of Extinction Rebellion, the campaign group which are aiming to highlight the climate and ecological catastrophe that we are all facing. They've been doing non-violent direct action over the past week and a bit, including up to 150 arrests, I think we're at now, and this culminated in Rebellion Day, where they blocked 5 London bridges in an attempt to draw attention to what is going on with our climate. BBC's coverage took the government's line. Its environment analyst said, "The government has kept pace with the step-by-step targets so far, mostly by stopping coal burning for electricity." That's not quite the case. The Committee on Climate Change reported that the government is set not to meet its final targets, and this is what Extinction Rebellion are so concerned about. I'm quite a big fan of theirs. I think what they're doing is great. I don't think that politics or corporations have the answer to the catastrophe we're facing. I think it rests in the hands of all of us to do what we can and take direct action. So if you're not, get involved with Extinction Rebellion. You can check out my article on it. Link will be in the show notes. Next up, we're off to The Guardian, and on Friday the 16th of November, it reported that UK austerity has inflicted great misery on citizens, UN says. This is, of course, the story of Philip Alston, the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, who has been in the UK on a fact-finding mission to find out just what the hell is going on in our country. 14 million people in poverty, 1.9 million below the destitution line. So Mr. Alston's been over here getting information from people, finding out people's true stories. However, there's an issue with The Guardian's report. There's been an issue with the whole media's report on this. It failed to mention that before Philip Alston came, we have had 4 reports already from the UN. There was the UN Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, there was the UN Human Rights Committee report, and there have been 2 reports by the UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. These 2 were the most scathing, accusing the UK government of committing grave and systematic violations of disabled people's human rights, resulting in a human catastrophe. But The Guardian thought, we don't need to know about that. This is appalling. The whole context of Philip Alston's visit is that we have been here 4 times before. The UN keeps investigating the UK, and the Tories just keep brushing it off. To be fair to Alston, he was damning in his criticism, saying that this situation was a political choice, ideologically driven, and basically it was a disaster. And anyone on the front line knows who is suffering under this that he is not wrong. So, over to ITV News 4 story number 3. On the 15th of November, it reported that
Peers blocked Lord Leicester's suspension over sexual harassment claims.
This is the story of Lord Leicester of Herne Hill, who, according to ITV News, an inquiry found had groped a woman and promised her a peerage for sex in 2006. Allegedly. So, the Lords Committee for Privileges and Conduct suspended Lord Leicester until 2022. But in a vote this week in the House of Lords, all his peers buddied together and voted that this suspension should be lifted and that the decision should be sent back to this committee. Green-peered Baroness Jenny Jones was absolutely incensed by this. You should check out her Twitter feed, at Green Jenny Jones. She's going into one, and quite rightly so. What is going on here? We already know we live in a misogynistic hierarchical society where men dominate, and the House of Lords is doing nothing to dispel this notion. Moreover, the House of Lords is unelected. They sit on their backsides half the time sleeping and get £300 a day for the privilege. Surely with this scandal and others on top of it, it is time to get rid of the House of Lords and at least give us an elected chamber instead of all these old farts sitting around doing nothing. I want to apologise in advance, I'm afraid, because we're over to the Daily Mail now for the next story. On the 15th of November, it reported that blunder that saw nearly 50,000 women miss out on smear test invites and results undermines public confidence, warns Health Minister as NHS announces a major overhaul of cancer screening programmes. This is a story that Capita, the outsourcing giant, failed to deliver letters for smear appointments to over 48,000 women this year, and some of these letters even contained their test results. This is an absolutely outrageous scandal from the outsourcing contractor, but unsurprising considering it's behind the debt collection for TV licensing and the failing PIP test for the Department for Work and Pension. This is another example of failing outsourcing by our government, zombie privatisation, giving public services away for private profit, which is, of course, the Conservatives' raison d'etre. I know some women who have gone from 6 monthly smears to 3 yearly ones under this programme, which is now under the responsibility of Capita. But moreover, that some women of a certain age are now given vaccinations for cervical cancer, whereas others are not. There is a real disproportionate approach to cervical cancer in this country, leaving some women on the scrap who've been some women protected. And this is all the more scandalous with Jade Goody, the Big Brother star's legacy, when everyone was up in arms about this. We seem to be regressing on this issue. And finally, I'm going back home to the Canary, and Joshua Funnell. He wrote a story on the 15th of November called May's Terrible Brexit Deal Could See Corbyn's Socialism Banned from the UK. This is about the finer details of the withdrawal agreement that's been reached between Theresa May and the EU. Check out Owen Jones and Aaron Bastani on Twitter. Bless them, they were getting themselves in knots over this. This is basically saying that there are certain things in place in this agreement which could limit Labour's ability to put policies into practice if it came into government. Namely, it may affect things like rent caps, energy price caps, wage caps, affordable state housing. It would also impede on Labour's ability to provide state subsidies to industries like farming and the energy tech sector. Sound quite bad? Yes, I think it is. Two elements to this. Firstly, are the Conservatives trying to pull a fast one on Labour here? We all know what happened at the last election. Labour started off very lowly in the polls and surged 20% over the course of the campaign period, not least due to a manifesto which was immensely popular with the public. So it seems the Tories, by implementing this in the EU agreement, are trying to limit Labour's power to put into practice policies which are extremely popular with the public. But we also have to remember, secondly, with the story, that we are dealing with the EU, an inherently corporatist, capitalist organisation which does not like states doing their own thing and does not like any form of progressive socialism. We only have to see that with what's happened with Greece. So, are the Tories and the EU ganging up on Labour? I'm not sure it's quite that, but either way, this agreement is not good enough for Labour, and as we know anyway, it's not good enough for any of us. And on top of all of that, I haven't even had time to mention that the Tories have quietly slipped out that 125 academy school bosses are earning more than £150,000 a year when school exclusions have gone up over 70% in the past 4 years. Nor have I had time to talk about my mate George Galloway, who's launched an amazing film about the killing of Dr. David Kelly. Tony Blair, what's that? What's that on your hands? Nor have we even talked about that there's the first public boycott of Israel has been started by a US Congresswoman, Ilhan Omar, getting a huge support in America for her BDS. Long may it continue. And finally, I hadn't even mentioned the fact that the all-party parliamentary group on infant feeding and inequalities has been hearing awful stories of women having to water down baby milk because they can't afford powder. What is going on in this country? I could go on for hours, but that is this week's Plucked News. For all these stories and more, check the show notes. Go to www.thecanary.co or check out Twitter at TheCanaryUK. That's Plucked News, all done for another week. I'm going for a cigarette. Dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, Free Flying, with... So, joining me for Free Flying this week, it's only lawyer and campaigner, the legendary Peter Stevanovich.
Steve, it is such an honour to be your first guest.
This is the first of many, hopefully, Peter. So what we're going to do, we're going to rattle through three big news stories this week. First off, it's the Brexit shambles that's going on. So we're recording this on a Friday afternoon, just so the listeners know. So goodness knows what's going to happen when it's gone out by Sunday. Peter, I'm going to put it to you. So was this Brexit shambles, do you think, always inevitable, given that the Tories inherently divided on the EU? So was it always going to be this way?
In a single word, yes. I mean, let's just park on the shelf the fact that the Tory party is split irrevocably down the middle on Brexit. It was always going to be the case that delivering a deal along the lines of that sort of fantasy Brexit advertised at the time of the referendum was going to be impossible. We were never going to have a utopia Brexit where we could just leave the single market, leave the customs union, retain all the same benefits, have that extra 350 million quid a week for the NHS. It was just never going to happen. So coming up with an agreement, coming up with a deal that might unify the Tory party behind something that, didn't just deliver Brexit, but actually did it in a way that, sort of fulfilled the fantasy in which Brexit was advertised, was just never going to happen. And, you know, we are almost certainly going to be looking at a leadership contest. I reckon, you know, by the end of next week. And, you know, the irony of irony is that the sort of trigger man on this is Jacob Rees-Mogg. And I tell you what really, really struck me, Steve, about his reasoning for doing this. Now, we've seen him pontificating all over the place, all over the media, about May's manifesto pledge and her promise to deliver the Brexit that he, you know, he wanted. And I've heard him twice this week talking about the importance of politicians delivering on their election promises. And I'm listening to this guy and I'm thinking, hang on a minute, you know, where was this multimillionaire who lives in a stately home, who thinks food banks are uplifting, who voted against landlords being obliged to ensure rental property is fit for human habitation? Where was this guy when Theresa May was breaking practically every single manifesto pledge she ever made?
I think you're correct. I think we will see next week that this will unfold. But obviously, whether this will spark a general election or not obviously remains to be seen. So briefly, in 30 seconds, Peter, do you think we're going to have a general election this year? Come on, put your money where your mouth is for me.
I would love to see a general election. I mean, Labour's position, I think, on this has been absolutely right. I mean, they've respected the referendum. They've watched the Tories self-destruct. Yeah. And, of course, even the Tories say it's a bad deal. I think a general election is going to be the only answer. If there isn't a general election, of course, Labour has quite rightly said all options are on the table, including a people's vote.
We may well know by the end of next week. So when Topple Uncaged comes back next Sunday after this one, then we might know the future of the country then. So moving swiftly on, and you segued quite nicely into that, let's talk about Corbyn on Newsnight. Emily Maitlis managed to do two hits on Corbyn in one programme on the 13th of November.
Wait, that way, Steve, it doesn't sound not very nice.
Well, the BBC not being nice to Corbyn. Labour have officially complained, actually, to BBC Newsnight, because they're saying this is categorically untrue. Corbyn campaigned for Remain in the EU referendum. He didn't always want to leave the EU, etc., etc. But, I mean, this BBC bias, it's constant against Labour. You've seen it from studies with the Media Reform Coalition, which point out the staggering, I think it's something like 53% of news articles across the spectrum never gives Corbyn's point of view on things, and the BBC are particularly guilty of this. There was a whole incident with Laura Koonsberg being punished by the BBC Trust for misrepresenting Corbyn in an interview about shoot to kill policy with regards to terrorism. So, but this constant bias by the BBC, how damaging really is this to Labour?
I mean, the first thing I would say is let's put what's happened this week with Newsnight, with the BBC, into context, because last year, Newsnight played the wrong clip of Corbyn responding to the budget. I don't know if you remember this.
Well remembered.
But Newsnight basically showed a clip of Corbyn responding to the spring budget rather than the November budget. And they explained it away by saying, oh, it was a production error. Now, you know, I'm an amateur. And I was thinking, you know, I wouldn't have made a mistake like that. And they didn't make a mistake like that for anybody else. Then you've got earlier this year, you'll recall Newsnight used an image of Corbyn in that, do you remember that Lenin-style cap in front of a
Moscow skyline? And they had the audacity to say it wasn't photoshopped.
The suggestion being that they used it to make him look more Russian. And the thing is, you know, that image, remember, was used in the context of an episode of Newsnight in which the programme was discussing Corbyn's reaction to the yes. Skripal poisoning. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. So these sorts of allegations are by no means new. But, I mean, what we saw earlier this week yeah. just took the thing to a whole new level. It's the weekend, and I tend to be a bit more charitable to people at the weekend. So if I'm being charitable to Emily Maitlis, I might say, well, look, she's probably talking about two things here. Firstly, the Tories failing on Brexit, and that failure leading to a general election and a change of government. But clearly very, very yeah. poor choice of words. But you then got her going on to repeatedly say Corbyn supports leaving the EU and suggesting he's sort of ideologically wedded to Brexit, when we all know he campaigned on a Remain platform. Exactly. You know, and as you just pointed out, you know, I mean, that there is data that shows the BBC itself is partly to blame for Corbyn's lack of airtime and voice during yes. the referendum. Coming back to your initial question, though, I don't believe it's as damaging to the Labour Party as it would have been 2 or 3 years ago. And the reason I say that is because of people like you and I and those wonderful platforms, you know, the Canary, another angry voice, Evolve Politics, putting out the real facts into a domain where the public is now able
exactly
to access.
Exactly so.
We're taking on mainstream media. You and I know that traditionally, you know, we've had a handful of billionaires controlling the political narrative, you know, the establishment controlling the political narrative. Yes. It terrifies them that we're now challenging them. You know, I mean, the establishment is terrified of Corbyn. You know, he wants to create a society that's fairly equal for everyone. Yes. Heaven forbid a man like that ever gets the
exactly
keys
to
number 10,
and I think that's sort of the crux of the matter for me, Peter, is that, I mean, it's not for me the inherent bias from the mainstream press, especially the BBC, who are supposed to be free, impartial, independent, the world's greatest broadcaster that we all have to pay for on the pain of jail if we don't. I think it's an inherent concern from establishment outsets. It's not, I don't think it's even so much about Corbyn. I think it's more what Corbyn represents and putting power into the grassroots in this country that really scares
absolutely.
The establishment media. And that
absolutely
segues us
right.
nicely into the final part we're going to talk about today. You did a staggering tweet this week about the right unhonourable Jeremy Hunt. You tweeted saying, "Your hypocrisy is simply breathtaking. By allowing the export of a staggering $4.3 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia to carry out its bombing campaign in Yemen, you are complicit in creating the very, quote, man-made humanitarian catastrophe of which you speak." I am staggered day in, day out by our politicians' attitude towards Yemen. I mean, we know why it is. It's partly due to arms sales. It's partly to do that the UK has £11 billion worth of investment projects in Saudi Arabia. It's partly geopolitical with supporting Saudi Arabia so we maintain a foothold in the Middle East. But it's just breathtaking. And it's so...
It is. You know, it's not just the sale of arms. I mean, just last week we heard the RAF has trained more than 100 Saudi pilots. I mean, it's extraordinary. I don't speak for the Labour Party, of course, but my understanding is that if in government, Labour would stop right away the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia. And, you know, just a few weeks ago, we had members of the European Parliament unanimously calling for an EU-wide arms embargo. Germany's already halted all arms sales to Saudi Arabia, but Theresa May continues to resist calls to follow suit. So there's a very good argument, actually, that the government's breached its own rules, that it shouldn't engage in weapons sales, where there's a clear risk the arms might be used in the commission of a serious violation of international law.
If I could just interject, exactly so. And I mean, firstly, Saudi Arabia is one of the countries on their human rights watch list, which they're selling arms to, which we all know about this. But also the UN said last year that it had directly linked the deaths of over 500 children to Saudi bombing campaigns. Therefore, by default, the UK is complicit in this because we sell them part of the planes and part of the bombs and part of the equipment that was dropped on these children to kill them. So I'm sure legally there is a case, and I know Amnesty brought one.
Is it important to make a point here? Because, you know, you get a lot of Tory ministers referring to a court case, that high court case last year. I don't know if you remember this, Steve, that last year, the CAAT, which I think is Campaign Against Arms Trade, is that the CAAT? I mean, they failed in an attempt in the high court to stop the UK government selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And the group was basically arguing that selling weapons to a country implicated in civilian deaths in Yemen breached the government's own rules, that it shouldn't engage in weapon sales when there was a clear risk the arms might be used in the commission of a serious violation of humanitarian law. Now, just coming back to that tweet, I mean, right now we've got UK-made fighter jets flown by UK-trained pilots firing UK-made missiles, you know, dropping UK-made bombs in Yemen, all whilst the UN's warning that Yemen is on the verge of the worst famine anywhere in the world in over 100 years. I mean, if that does not put what the Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, said into, you know, the dizzying hypocrisy that
no,
it was,
I
nothing
completely
will,
agree.
You know, I get very angry. I get very, very angry about this subject and the government's position, because it is indefensible.
It is indefensible, but unfortunately, Peter, as we know, nearly everything our Conservative government does is completely indefensible. They're absolutely awful, and we can only hope that Brexit shenanigans come true and that there is a general election soon. Peter, that is all from us.
Absolutely. It was lovely to chat, Steve. I hope you're going to have me back again.
I certainly will. Peter Stevanovic, you're a legend. Thank you for joining me.
Take care.
Taking down this week's BBC QT, it's question time. Topple chirps back. Question time. The BBC's flagship political programme gets more and more irksome by the week. From the same tired panellists trotting out the same tired narratives, to its cherry-picked audience, often consisting of councillors and more gammon than Bill the Butcher from round the corner has got. But perhaps most irritating about the programme is its constant obsession with Brexit. Brexit, 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 Brexit. Week in, week out, there's a question on Brexit, often ignoring more pressing issues that this country is facing. But this week's edition was no exception to that rule. We had a whole show dedicated to Brexit, with every question centering around this damn subject, which is getting more and more chaotic by the week. So, what have you got for me, question time, this week? First question, please.
How long can Theresa May last?
A nice, simple question. How long can Theresa May last?
The question shouldn't be how long Theresa May can last. The question should be, how the hell do we allow Theresa May to become Prime Minister in the first place? Let's not forget, this is a woman who oversaw, as Home Secretary, the conception of the Windrush scandal. She cut police numbers to the bone, left our prison systems in chaos, and sent go-home vans around multicultural communities. This is one of the most nefarious and nasty politicians of this decade, and how we let her become Prime Minister is the bigger question that we should be asking. Next one, please.
Is no deal better than this deal?
No deal better than this deal.
Neither of those deals are better than any other deal, in my opinion, because the problem we have is we have a Conservative government who, if we have no deal and we crash out of the EU, as they keep quoting, they're going to trot around the world, not least the US, doing some of the dodgiest deals going, selling out our country, invoking even more corporatist capitalism to come into these shores. And if we do a deal with the EU, as the one Theresa May appears to have negotiated, those aren't going to serve our interests either. You can already see from the details of the EU withdrawal bill that has been agreed that some of Labour's plans won't even be possible thanks to Theresa May's dodgy dealings and the EU's inherently corporatist nature. So, no deal, the deal we've got, neither are good enough. What are we going to do about it? Final question, please.
Is a people's vote the only democratic answer to a parliamentary shambles?
Okay, the people's vote, an answer to a parliamentary shambles. And Matthew, let's have yours.
Are we heading for another general election?
Are we heading for another general election?
I'm glad the question of a general election is so funny to you all. Never mind, there's 14 million people in poverty in this country, 1.9 million of them in destitution, 4 million children in poverty. But, you know, a general election is funny. So, should we have a people's vote? Should we have a general election? I think, in the short term, this is very clear cut. I'm with Labour on this one. I think we should be having a general election, because a people's vote is not the correct answer to this at all. We had a referendum, and how many times do you want to run that referendum until people get the answer they want? But more to the point, we should be asking about whether our democracy in this country is truly broken. Because let's not forget, whatever your thoughts on the EU referendum, it's now fully clear that it was got off the back of a dodgy campaign by Leave EU, not least centred around Aaron Banks. And of course, the whole EU referendum itself came off the back of the most disproportionate general election in British history, the 2015 general election. And we all seem to have forgotten the fact that that came off the back of the Tories overspending, according to the Electoral Commission, but they didn't overspend on purpose because they didn't realise what they were doing. So ultimately, of course, there was no Tory election fraud in 2015. No, nothing to see here, not at all. So, of course, whether we should be asking whether it's a general election or the people's vote is kind of irrelevant. We should be asking bigger questions of the democracy in this country that can allow a Conservative Party to essentially commit electoral fraud and create this chaos that we now see before us. Thank you, Question Time. That's all for this week. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. I am so excited about my next guest. In fact, to be honest, I nearly shat myself when I got the phone call saying, yes, this man would be coming on. It is only the legendary rapper Loki joining me for my first ever revolutionary birdsong section. Loki, thank you so much for coming on board. So what's going on? You've got a new track called Refuse to Kill out. Tell me all about that.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. It's an honour to be one of the first guests, as far
My
as
pleasure.
I understand. So the song Refuse to Kill is about the 20,000 people that in the midst of what I would describe as systematised insanity, the 20,000 people that refused to join the British Army. Of them, 6,000 of them were imprisoned. Okay. Around 80 of those people that were imprisoned actually died during their time in prison. And 34 of them were actually taken to France and sentenced to death in Britain. It was only thanks to the mobilization of Bertrand Russell and his ability to convince Herbert Asquith, the Prime Minister at the time, that it would be against his interest to do so, that those execution orders were later commuted.
Okay. But that's, to be honest, that's not the narrative that we ever hear in the mainstream media. That's not what we hear, especially around Remembrance Day. I mean, we should be proud, and being in the army is a good thing. And you know, that's not really what we hear at all from the mainstream press.
So it's looking at that legacy of anti-war activism.
Okay.
At a time when, you know, a lot of the mainstream media would have you believe that everybody was rushing to join the army and fight. So it's looking at what sacrifices those people made and what type of societal disdain to some extent they were met with, but also the successes. You know, we are told that they were a really, really minuscule minority, and that after that, you know, we're led to believe the kind of Keir Hardy story that after when he died, because of his anti-war activism, he wasn't mentioned in Parliament or anything else. That's not actually a reflection of the way that these people were perceived by society. Fenner Brockway, who was in prison during that period and actually kept in solitary confinement for a long time, came out and was later voted an MP. Ramsay MacDonald, of course, had been a prominent anti-war activist. While he was not a conscientious objector and was not imprisoned, he was in situations during the World War One where he was, you know, attacked on the street. He later went on to become the Prime Minister. So the point is that anti-war activism has existed throughout the last century of extreme human suffering in Britain, and we actually have a real heritage in that sense to be proud of.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's over the sort of past 100 years, there's loads of groups that have had major successes in sort of in anti-war activism, isn't there? There's been countless ones.
Whether it is the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, whether it is the Schools Against Bombs movement, largely started by the CND. You know, at the same time when the United States wanted to put cruise missiles in Britain in order to target the Soviet Union, there has always been resistance, whether it's the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign, which stopped Harold Wilson from sending British troops to join the United States in Vietnam. We have a proud tradition of anti-war activism all the way up to 2003, when we had the largest simultaneous mobilization of human beings in recorded history in the march against the Iraq War.
So is that what Refuse to Kill is basically saying, that in 2018 that there's a lot we can learn from historical activism and historical successes of activism? Is that what Refuse to Kill is saying?
So we have traditions that we can take pride in, and in many ways their foundation is in World War One. And so this song is about bringing to light those characters and making us think about their plight at that time and what the cost was and the sacrifice was to resist war in Britain.
And at that point, he had to go because I think he was at a demonstration. But that was Loki. He is such a legend. And the depth of thought that man has is staggeringly good. He is a superstar. Loki joining me for my very first revolutionary bird song on my very first Canary Pod, Topple Uncaged. Wow. And here it is, This is a sneak preview of Loki's massive new song, absolutely stunning piece of work, Refuse to Kill, courtesy of my mates at Going Underground. If you want to hear the full version, just go to their YouTube, Going Underground, or you can check the show notes out where details will be there. Loki, Refuse to Kill. We're searching for no time to molly coddle. Too many bodies were sold before. This is the feeling that stopped them loading SS Jolly George. He died in jail due to their treatment. Sacrificed their lives for the most human of reasons. Monsters on the conscience, so delusions of freedom. The refusal to kill, a conviction you can't believe. I refuse to kill. I refuse to make. I refuse to fly. No, not in my name. I refuse to kill. I refuse to make. I refuse to fly. Hardy pass without a mention of parliament. Alienation targeting, afterwards it was half of them. He considered Belgium as colonizers we can't defend. Sent to kill fellow workers by a wretched class of heartless men. Still draw the borders in places that they trample. Conscription isn't physical, but it remains financial. Participants in carnage, but from the strangest of angles. Don't prolong the mental bondage, time the cages dismantled. Women's peace crusade contribution can't be forgotten. Legacy still alive and was fighting at Greenham Common. These are the real heroes, not Fandam or Rambo. They shut the city down and banned Lloyd George from Glasgow. Better to die with honor than And that's it. Show one of Topple Uncaged done. I would like to thank my brilliant guests, Peter Stevanovic and the incredible Loki. I'd also like to thank behind the scenes Nicola Jeffrey, my fabulous girlfriend. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. And also to Raystar Music, the amazing young lady who did the vocals for me. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray_star113. Also, thank you to the Canary for uncaging me. I hope you know what you're letting yourselves in for. Please don't forget to join us at the Canary. Become a member. More details at www.canary.co. Until next week, look after yourselves. I'm out.
Uncaged.